whole quarter of a century has passed, and it's the start of yet another year. Now, there are a lot of signs that point to that, one of them being there's snow outside, so this is a good sign. It's probably January in Illinois. There are a lot of other things that point us towards this new year. All of the advertisements, all of those things that seem so much more routine. I know I went back to the Vaughn Athletic Center over here after 2 weeks of too much Christmas, and you come back to the gym, and it's like, where on earth did all of these people come from? Right? It is just nuts. Everything takes so much longer. There are so many people. And there's the reality of having been through it before. You realize those statistics really do bear out. Right? Google it. 88% of people give up their New Year's resolution in 2 weeks. Like, it is very quick to see the attrition rate, right? It seems a little bit longer that than, you know, the people at the Vaughn, but man, by the end of the month, it'll be back about the way it used to be. There'll be one or two more new faces that have decided to stick it out, right? At the start of the new year, all of our advertisements, all of our thoughts tend to garner towards all renewed effort. We need to try harder. We need to buckle down. We need to get the discipline going. There are so many things we want to do, and so we garner our power and our strength and try to make them happen. That's kind of the focus so often of the new year. And I find it so greatly wonderful in God's providential irony that we're doing a sermon series on what to start the new year? When I am weak. Well, let's be honest. At least maybe it's me, but most people I talk to, we recognize what? We don't really like weakness. I have yet to be convinced that there are many people who really actually do like weakness. I don't know, maybe it's just me. I was thinking this Christmas season, my father-in-law had taken a really bad fall right before Christmas, and so he was in a wheelchair with a broken femur and a broken arm. And so it was, you know, kind of a rough thing. And you're really dependent upon other people at that point. And that just kind of reminded me of having had arm surgery when I had my bicep reattached. And, you know, I had heard the horror stories about, you know, some of the narcotic family of drugs, you know. So I was like, give me a few pills in case I need them, but I'm not going to need them. Right? And so you go to bed, you're feeling good. Wake up, oh, my arm's kind of hurting. I need to go to the bathroom. I'll get a drink and then I'll go out and watch some TV so I don't wake Tori up. First part of that went great. Get the water, start to take a drink, the arm starts throbbing, it kind of moves up into your head, and all of a sudden you're realizing, I can't see the world anymore. And, you know, like your body starts, you know, so it's in that moment you have that great moment to decide, well, I'm going to hit the floor either way. I'm going to lean back, but I should also probably call for help at this moment, right? And so there's that humbling moment. It's like, honey, I need help. I'm going down and there's nothing I can do about it. And like, I'm going to need somebody to pick me back up and make sure I didn't kill myself on the way down. Right? There are those moments that greatly humble us. And we don't tend to like that if we are honest. It pushes against our self-sufficiency, doesn't it? And we recognize how much our culture bears into that. We live in a culture of strength, of the self-made man or woman. We love the story in America of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, doing what nobody else can do, and coming out on top. And I'm struck by this great irony when we look at this sermon series we've started this year in 2 Corinthians. The world that Paul lived in looks an awful lot like the world we live in. Paul was ministering to a community that loved strength. They loved prowess. They loved things that were impressive to other people. Paul has been preaching, and he comes and he preaches this gospel of weakness that requires great humility. And then these super apostles come in to Corinth, and they preach this health and wealth false gospel. And they put forth as their pedigree their ethnic prowess, their ability to speak profoundly and use words in wonderful ways. They put forth their material wealth and how God has blessed them as evidence that they are in fact the true apostles. Because, hey, after all, wouldn't you rather look like us than like Paul? Right? And that is a very easy argument we can see to believe. And so Corinth is struggling. And Paul writes these letters back and forth, and things have gone from bad to worse by the time we get to 2 Corinthians. And what does Paul do? We could expect Paul to whip out his pedigree and brag on it. But instead, what is he going to do? He's going to double down on the theme of weakness. He is going to put forth his suffering as the ultimate evidence that the gospel is true. Because we have a suffering Messiah, and the path to victory is one through death to resurrection, not one of victorious living here and now. And so as we travel to this short passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 today, we want to just ask a couple of questions. First, how does Paul redefine weakness and power for the Corinthians? How does he redefine that? Because we recognize he's pushing back against a very similar culture to the one we have. But we can't stop there. Then we have to turn and ask that really challenging question. How do we need to redefine our understanding in weakness and power if we're going to be the type of followers of Jesus that we want to be? So let's take that first question. How does Paul redefine weakness and power? And the first thing we're going to see this in verse 7. How does Paul redefine what weakness says about ourselves in light of God's powerful purposes? Paul's going to see that there is a purpose in our weakness, and that when we embrace it, it enables the power of God to be seen in a new and a profound way. And so we read verse 7 here. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. Treasure. What's the treasure? If we go back and look at the first 6 verses, it becomes clear that this treasure is the gospel. This gospel is the light that transforms the Corinthians. This treasure is the profound wonder of the gospel. If you're here and you've embraced the gospel, you know that this is a profound treasure. What does it do? It frees us from the debt we owe to sin. It frees us from condemnation to sin. It frees us from the power of sin. It frees us from being under the dominion of darkness and brought into the kingdom of life. We who were once enemies of God have now been made his friends and his children. This is the great wonder of the gospel. Jesus refers to the gospel of this kingdom as what? A pearl of great price. Wise is the merchant who would sell everything he has, all of his vast wealth, to go and acquire this. It is of immeasurable value. Now, we all recognize what? If we have things of value, we tend to put them in certain places, right? Whether you're old school, and that means underneath your mattress, right? But I'm a little more new school when it comes to that. We came back from Christmas, and in our family, anything that has to do with paper, including physical money paper, comes to me and not to Tori, because if it goes to Tori, we just refound a check from June, okay? And she would openly admit this, right? So this, I'm not throwing her under the bus, just even though she's not in here this morning, right? But there's just this reality. And so all, you know, like, everybody's like, you can either keep it and then it's on you, or you can give it to me and I will make sure that it gets, you know, to where it needs to be. And, you know, we're getting back and unpacking and everything, and I'm getting ready the next day, and I'm like, oh, snap. I still have a whole large wad of cash in my gym bag as I'm getting ready. I was like, we need to take that to the bank, right? We know where treasure goes. We need a place to put it where it's safe. And that makes what Paul says next so remarkably and totally crazy, right? Where is this treasure? It's in jars of clay. And the whole purpose here, Paul is drawing a stark contrast between a treasure of immeasurable value and a jar of clay. Now, to help us recognize this here, we have this problem because in our world, we think of ceramics as an art form, right? I remember when my brother took pottery. You know, and he made really cool things. And being somebody who has never really been blessed with the artistic gifts, always was kind of in awe of that, right? There is that piece, and this, it looks really, really cool, right? We think of pottery as art. But in the ancient world, pottery is ordinary, right? It is what everything gets stored in, from your water to your food to your cooking oil. It is everywhere. It also has one other fundamental flaw that we sometimes don't forget. If I said, hey, catch, right? What happens the moment this hits the ground? It chips, if not shatters. My dad was an archaeologist. And so when he passed away, one of the unique challenges we had was to deal with some of the artifacts that he had. Now, some of the artifacts were really, really cool. And so, you know, SciTech took a whole bunch of his artifacts and put out together this, you know, Bible Times exhibit, and then it went on traveling around. But there were 5 file cabinets full of pottery shards. And I don't know that you would imagine, it was really, really hard to find anybody who wants 5 cabinets full of pottery shards. Right? Because pottery is all over the ancient world. But the whole point for an archaeologist is, why do you have 5 cabinets full of pottery shards? Because these teach you how to date everything in the biblical world, right? You date it by the pottery because you can tell the shape and the craft and the firing and all these little things that represent different eras. So Paul wants us to make sure we get here that this jar is not an art form. This is something that is ordinary, and it's something that's incredibly fragile. The exact opposite of the treasure that he's talking about. Why? Why put something so amazing in something ordinary, something common, and something very fragile? Well, Paul says it has a profound purpose. It's to show the surpassing value, the surpassing power that belongs to God and not to us. Right? That word power is a great word. It's the word we get in English from the Greek. It means dynamite, right? It is explosive power. That word surpassing is literally the word we in English get our term hyperbole, right? Like, this is hyperbolic dynamite power, right? To give us a picture here in English, this is greater than any other type of power, and yet it has been put into this. Why? So that there will be no doubt that the power does not belong to the vessel, right? Now, we have to confess that there is this problem, because sometimes when you read certain writers, when you hear certain people talk, they kind of change the equation a little bit, and they kind of make it like this. My weakness plus God's power means my power, right? But Paul wants us to be very clear. You are weak. God is strong. Your weakness shows God's power. It is not your power. It is not ever about us. It is not ever about elevating ourselves. It's always about elevating the treasure. And in fact, Paul says, this is exactly why God so often throughout Scripture uses the ordinary. God uses the broken. Because when people look at the broken, they don't mistake it for treasure. Right? It's like, that's all God. Right? No doubt about it. Like, there is no way that ordinary broken person, that's not them. There's only one explanation for how that can possibly be happening, and it's the Almighty. It is the surpassing power of God that makes that happen. And so Paul redefines power and weakness for who we are. There is this powerful purpose, and when we embrace weakness, we get to play a part in revealing the power of God. And then we move on to verses 8 and 9, and we say, how does Paul redefine what weakness says about our experiences in light of God's sustaining power? Moving from ourselves to our experiences, how do they get redefined through this lens of weakness in light of God's sustaining power? Because he's going to give us these 4 contrasts. Verses 8 and 9. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. And here we recognize the way the operation of the world normally works. If you are squeezed, if you are afflicted on every side, you eventually get crushed. Right? If you are perplexed, if you lose understanding what happens, eventually you're driven to despair. If you don't know why, eventually it drives you crazy. If you're persecuted, it means you've been forsaken. If you are struck down repeatedly, eventually you don't get up again. But yet Paul is going to say there is a sustaining power of God in the midst of this. Let's just break each of those down real quick. Afflicted, but not crushed. Literally in Greek, this is the word to squeeze something. This is the word Jesus uses to describe that camel going through the eye of a needle, right? You're going to have to squeeze that camel an awful lot. This is the word used when Jesus is in the crowds and people are pressing around him on every side, trying to touch him. Right? This is profound pressure. It's being squeezed in. It's being hemmed in on every side. Yet what does it say? Not being crushed. Somehow being sustained despite all that Paul has experienced, despite his continual burden for all the churches, despite all of these letters, despite all the circumstances, he has not been crushed by a load that should crush any human being. Next, perplexed but not driven to despair. And here we recognize Paul, super apostle to the Gentiles, right? Never driven to despair. Well, sometimes I think we get this picture of Paul as almost like this Terminator gospel planting machine. He just like keeps going, right? But I love the way 2 Corinthians opened. Let's read this in 2 Corinthians 1:8. It says, "For we do not want you to be unaware, brothers, of the affliction we experienced in Asia, for we were so utterly burdened beyond our strength that we despaired of life itself." Here is Paul. He says, "I have been to the brink of despair. I thought I had given up on life, but yet here I testify that God somehow got me through it." These are not the words of somebody who skates above. These are the words of somebody who has gone through the depths of suffering and profound persecution and declares, "God's sustaining power has gotten me through." And we need to acknowledge that following Jesus can sometimes be a really confusing thing, right? It sometimes we don't talk enough about it, but there are times, if we are honest, following Jesus is really hard because everything that we think is going to happen doesn't. And all the things we didn't think are going to happen do, right? We want to draw it up as this great straight line bar graph, but it doesn't work out that way. We need to be real that there are things that following Jesus, even in there, Paul, of all people, says, "I was driven to despair even of life itself from all of the crushing weights. But take heart, God sustained me and he will sustain you as well." Next pairing, persecuted but not forsaken. That's the word that literally means to hunt something down. When we read through Paul's letters, what do we see? At every turn, there are Jewish and other opponents who are following him. It's almost like he's the raccoon running towards the tree and the hounds are hot on his tail, right? There are people maligning his character, undermining his preaching, constantly stirring up division and opposition both inside and outside of the church, in the Jewish circles and in the Roman circles. He is constantly having this sense of being hunted down. But yet, what does it tell us? I have not been forsaken. But yet again, when we read through Paul's letters, we recognize he has been to the brink of being forsaken. He has been forsaken by people, but he has never been forsaken by Jesus. I love what he says in 2 Timothy 4:16 says, "At my first offense, no one came to stand by me, but all deserted me." There were times where he stood alone, but in those moments, Jesus stood with him. These are not the words of someone who has not known what it is like to feel forsaken by those around him, but they are the words of someone who in those moments felt the comforting grace and holding of Jesus when everything else was ripped away. He knows what it is like to walk that path. And last pairing, struck down but not destroyed. The backdrop of athletic language, being thrown to the ground as a wrestler, being hit with a succession of blows to which you're ready to pass out. And we can't help but think of the story of Paul in Lystra, right? Stoned to the point where he didn't get up again. They dragged his body out and left him for dead. And by the miraculous sustaining power of God, he gets up and he goes to the next town and keeps preaching. Paul has literally walked this road and metaphorically, and he says, God has sustained in ways I do not understand and cannot possibly imagine. I love how J. Philip Arthur summarizes this. He says, taken together, these four images tell us that Paul was a hard-hearted realist with no romantic illusions about his service for God. Far from depicting himself as a spiritual superhero, blazing a trail of success like a comet across the first century sky, Paul portrayed himself as a groggy fighter, reeling from a succession of near-lethal blows, surprised to find himself still on his feet, and sure that if he was still standing, it was only by the grace of God. Paul would want us to hear that there is just as much profound revelation in the power of God seen through perseverance as there is in miraculous deliverance. Sometimes, in fact, there is more power of God and more glory revealed through the one who barely makes it through than through those who experience that miraculous deliverance. And then as we turn to verses 10 to 12, we ask this, how does Paul redefine what weakness says about life and death in light of gospel power and mission? Verses 10 to 12, moving from life and death in light of gospel power and mission. He continues on, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. Anybody else think that was a really confusing way to say that? Man, I rewrote this page like 15 times. Because I'm like, this is the most confusing sentence in the world. Because Paul basically says the same thing a couple of different ways, but each time he says it, it makes it less clear rather than more. It's almost the way it feels, isn't it? So maybe if we were to sit down with Paul, we'd say, hey, put that in more contemporary language. And Paul would tell us, dying makes life possible. That this is the heart of the gospel. Paul is sharing here the theological underpinnings of how he's seen the sustaining grace of God. He views these sufferings in light of what we call the divine passive voice. So one of the things to notice here is that all of this is talking about God's action, right? So Jesus, his suffering, it had a purpose in the mind of God. It wasn't just suffering for suffering's sake. It was suffering and the cross and being handed over to death and dying. All of that language points to the glorious resurrection that was for our good. And Paul says what? The same thing is happening in my life. This is my philosophy of ministry. It is that in my suffering and in my dying for the sake of the gospel, life is being broadcast all the more. Death points to life. It reveals not just the stories of Jesus, but the living power of Jesus that is alive now. And again, Greek is one of those confusing things because they have so many different words for things. And life is one of those. And so oftentimes when we think about life, we think about bios life. That's the biological life that we see and that exists. And then there's zoe life. This is the life that John 1 says is in God himself, and that he in turn brings as the light and the life that he brings and offers to all who would receive him. This is life of a completely different caliber, and that's the life here Paul is contrasting. It's not just death versus bios life. It's death versus zoe life, right? Death brings the end of bios, but it does not bring the end of zoe. In fact, death and suffering lead to greater zoe life because this is at the heart of the gospel. Paul wants us to get that it was absolutely worth it for Jesus to suffer and die because it brought about the glories of the resurrection and the bringing and buying forth of the redeemed. As Hebrews 12 puts it, what? For the joy set before him, Jesus endured the cross. And likewise, Paul wants us to hear, it is absolutely worth it for him. And this gets revealed through this wonderful twist. Because if we graph out verses 10 through 12, there's this pattern, right? Dying leads to life. Dying leads to my life. And then in verse 12, we expect, so we die, but also we live. But is that what Paul says? He gives us this one little twist here, doesn't he? He says, so death is at work in us. And we expect, but life is also at work in us. But instead he says, but life is in you. This is the great principle of the cross. That the one died that the others might live. The great exchange. And Paul pictures this as part of his goal, that in and through his suffering, it is absolutely worth it. Why? Because the Corinthians have been brought in to Zoe life. As George Mueller once declared, when he was asked what the secret was to his preaching and all of his work among children who were orphaned, and he said, the secret is there was a day that I died. I died to George Mueller. Right? There is a power and a profound transformation that can happen when we die to ourselves that enables newness of life and profound power to come out and to come forth for it. Paul wants us to know that dying is absolutely worth it. Why? Because there is a new life to be found. And that life isn't just for me. I have experienced it, and because I have experienced it, the goal is for that life and that mission to go forth in gospel power to all people. Death is at work in us, but it's worth it because life is at work in you. He wants us to absolutely see it. So we've taken a few minutes to redefine, to look at how Paul redefines the ideas of weakness and power. And we don't want to just stop there because we want Paul to speak in to our lives today through the power of the Holy Spirit. So how do we in turn need to redefine our understanding of weakness and power? Let's start with those same categories, thinking through ourselves, through our experiences, and through our understanding of life and death, starting with ourselves. We redefine what weakness says about ourselves in light of God's powerful purposes. And I think Paul would put it something like this. We need to see more clearly both the treasure and the clay. Because we have this inherent challenge of holding these things together, right? Most of us don't live well in tension, right? It's hard to keep the both and. And what do we see? There are tremendous consequences at either end of the spectrum, right? Because there are those who preach a gospel that is only treasure. It is all victory. It is all reward. If you suffer or you die, there's something wrong with you, right? And there's they've missed something by so focusing on the treasure aspect. And we know that's easy to push back against, but as we move over, it's a little more subtle. We recognize that in the age of influencers, in the age and time when we can have celebrity worship leaders and celebrity pastors, there is an inherent danger. Now we recognize, all right, just because you happen to be a pastor at a big church, it doesn't mean you're preaching a false gospel. That's not the message. But we recognize that in our American society, there is this fundamental tension that how many megachurch pastors look a whole lot like Paul? But then again, how many of any of us look that much like Paul? Right? So let's make sure we're not being judgmental there. But there is this inherent danger, this creeping in of our culture, right? Where we so easily latch onto just the treasure. And then for others of us, we need to hear that there is an inherent danger when we pull the treasure apart from the clay. Because so often in our desire to encourage other people, we can fall into the error and the danger in our fellowship groups, in our small groups, in our talking with other people, that we can forget the reality of the clay. And what happens when we separate them and we minimize the reality of living in the clay vessel? People can so easily walk away feeling wounded, disillusioned, and hurt. The goal is that they'd both be together. We got to hear the other end of the spectrum too, right? If it's all clay, if it's all fragility, if it's all ordinary, where's the treasure? Right? There are those moments, there are some people and you listen, it's like you've lost it, right? You've lost in despair, right? We feel that tension and most of us are given to one side or the other. You might be, you know, some of us are a little more extreme, some of us are a little less extreme, right? In the way that we go. But just as Jesus, what? He is indivisible clay and treasure, inseparable. So too is the gospel, that the gospel has been united to jars of clay. We are the way that is supposed to happen in this world. And there are profound challenges to us when we forget about that, aren't there? We need to hear anew and afresh that imperfect vessels are for some reason the way God chose to do it. Again and again throughout Scripture, we see it. Who did God choose to be the rock of the church? I think I'll double down on the disciple who's going to deny me three times. He's perfect! Apostles of the Gentiles? Hey, let's take that guy who just martyred Stephen. I want him. And sometimes we forget, don't we? How easily we can buy into the lie that we need to look better on the outside before we can proclaim this message. How often do we allow those lies to hinder our ability to speak forth that truth and that treasure because we look at ourselves and say, nobody's going to believe me. And Paul would look at you and go, exactly. It's not going to be you who's going to bring him into the kingdom. I know you know that, but you look like you need a reminder, right? We all do. We all need that at times, don't we? And we have to be real, right? There is this challenge here that we face, right? Because this is Paul. This is apostle to the Gentiles, right? Like, you know, like he's in this unique category, but what would Paul like come and say? Have any of you here ever experienced the treasure? Have any of you ever experienced the message of reconciliation? If so, guess what? God's plan today is still the treasure in jars of clay. The plan has not changed. It is still here. And we recognize that doesn't just apply to the apostle to the Gentiles. It doesn't just apply to vocational pastors or elders and deacons in the church. It doesn't just apply to small group leaders, right? We all face that challenge of being jars of clay entrusted with a treasure. And we can all so easily buy into that thought that somehow my imperfections are going to lead to challenges. Now that doesn't mean go seek out more challenges so the glory of, right? Paul has a whole argument about what shall we sin all the more so that grace may abound? By no means, right? Go read Romans 6 if you ask that question. He'll answer it there. But we recognize there is that challenge and we can't help but think about it in the workplace, right? Sometimes it's like, people are going to look at me like, you know, like, how are they ever going to believe that message, right, when I'm this struggled? Well, that makes the message all that more powerful. And think about that as well. We had a family worship experience this morning talking about family discipleship that Josh Anderson led. And so had a dozen of us gather in there and just sharing and just the reality, like, oh my goodness, the responsibility of being parents. It's crazy. Right? But if we waited till we were ready to have kids, no one would ever have kids, right? There's always that joke. And likewise, if we waited to disciple our kids until we felt like we were ready, oh man, graduation was a few years ago, right? Like, it's never going to happen. But we have to hear that profound truth that the gospel can shine all the more powerfully in our weakness. If we really begin to believe that, we'll share, we'll open up the vulnerability gates of our clay and let that be known. Now, obviously, that needs to be done with wisdom. That doesn't mean, you know, go tell your kids at 3 everything you did in college, right? If, you know, if you had one of those stories, that's not, you know, that's not wisdom, right? But there is that tension. And I feel that uniquely, right? As a pastor, like, there's that reality that, like, well, when you preach, you tend to tell certain types of stories. Like, you know, like, it's always good to leave people feeling encouraged in the redemption stories. It's like, the work in progress stories, they don't have the same kick to them, right? Like, you know, like, but there is that tension. We all feel that. We have to be able to be real because in the realness of the clay, the gospel is all the more revealed. So now we move on to that second area, redefining what weakness says about our experience in light of God's sustaining power. What would Paul want us to hear? I think he'd want us to hear, you will be knocked down, but Jesus will pick you up. Jesus will carry you. He would want us to hear that there is going to be hardship. I contemplated when, you know, this text first landed of preaching the entirety of chapter 4. Don't worry, we're not doing it. But one of the reasons I wanted to do that is because there's this beautiful bracket between 1 and 16. Paul says at the beginning in 2 Corinthians 4, if you have it open, you can flip there, it says, therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, what? We do not lose heart. He says, we don't lose heart. Why? Because this gospel ministry has been entrusted to us. But to recognize what? I'm saying we're not going to lose heart. What are we tempted to do? Lose heart. Right? We're tempted to give up. We're tempted to throw in the towel because it is hard. And then what does he come to at verse 16? He says, so we do not lose heart, even though our outer self is wasting away. Even though the bios, even though the corruption and the suffering and all the things are beating down upon us, what? We do not lose heart. Why? Because our inner self is being renewed day by day. God's powerful purposes are at work. His sustaining grace is there. It is worth it. Just don't give up. He will get you across the finish line. And here we want to make sure we differentiate the context of our text a little bit here. Because there are those things, the suffering that happens to us because we live in a fallen world and sometimes things are just hard and they are awful. Right? And there's encouragement in the scriptures for that. But that's not really the context that Paul's throwing at us here. The context that Paul's throwing at us here in 2 Corinthians 4 is this is the things that bear down on you because you're following Jesus. Right? Now, there are the things that just happen, and those are legitimate and they are hard, and we need to ask questions about them. But Paul here is saying there are those unique things that come down upon you because you are following me. Right? Now, Paul feels those very uniquely as the apostle to the Gentile, as going into foreign lands, as preaching in desperate places. Right? We have people that we know and support and pray for who have that calling. But this text isn't just for them. It's recognizing that there are all kinds of challenges that come when we follow Jesus, when we choose to open up our homes and welcome in strangers, when we choose to welcome in others, when we choose to open up our lives, when we choose to step out in our workplaces and bring Jesus with us. There is pushback. There is challenge. Now, most of us aren't going to face stoning literally as Paul did. But there are things that likewise can wear down on us, that can crush us. There is the perplexion. There is the wondering, like, Jesus, you asked me to do this, and I'm being faithful, and you said it would work out, and every observable sign it says it doesn't. In those moments, how do we persevere? It's the sustaining grace of God. It's knowing that I will be knocked down. And far too often in Christian circles, I think we have to redefine some of the terms we use, right? There is that victorious aspect, you know, it used to be the victorious Christian life. Now it's, I'm going to see a victory, right? There is wonderful truth in that. The problem is when Americans hear victory, they hear, it was hard, but now I'm the champion. Right? Like there's, you know, there's no great story without adversity, but it's still, I'm on top, I'm victorious. It's not, the world is crushed and victory is I'm still standing. Because that is sometimes what the promise of Christ is the promise is you have not been abandoned. You have not been let go of. Jesus will hold your hand and walk you through the valley of the shadow of death. And sometimes we need to redefine our understanding of victory. You will be knocked down. We don't talk enough about it in Christian circles so often. But equally true, Jesus will pick you back up. If not in this life, he will carry you through in victory to the next. That is our hope. And that leads us towards that last redefining. What does weakness say about life and death in light of gospel power and mission? Paul would want us to hear, dying to self is the path to true life. It's the only way. It's always been the only way to find it. And that comes down to trusting God with our weaknesses in profound ways, because there's times where it doesn't make sense. Because rather than artwork, most of us look a little more like my poor sad pot. Right? If you looked closely, the top half got broken off and I glued it back together. Do we really believe that in this brokenness, the light of Christ will shine more brightly than in my perfection? Because I still think, if I'm honest, oh, I struggle to really live that way. Like, intellectually, I will confess it because it is true. I can argue it from the scriptures. But if I am honest, God, just go ahead and take another chip out of my life if it'll let you shine more brightly. Please, no. Right? Do we really trust God? Do we really believe his promises that he can use every brokenness, that his glory will shine all the more, that it will somehow make us more like Jesus and bring him more glory than not? It's a hard and profound road to walk. But we recognize what? Anyone can sing when the light is bright. But it is those who sing in the darkness that transform lives. Paul and Silas in the chains, their worship in the pit spoke volumes to the Philippian jailer and prepared his heart for believing in Jesus that he might be saved. To recognize the light shines most brightly in the darkness, that the world may not respect our preaching, it may not respect our apologetic arguments, but there is something profound about a life of joy lived in the midst of persecution and challenge. There is something profound about light that is seen within an individual in the midst of profound brokenness that no one can deny. We are reminded that despite our awe, there's still no other way. There's still no other vessel that has been appointed other than us. The ordinary, the fragile, and the broken. Jesus declared, "All authority on heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore go to all the world and make disciples." But lo, remember, you do not go alone. I am with you always until the very end of the age. So in our brokenness, may we pray that God's light shine all the brighter. Amen. All right, as we